subject tonight deals with the concept of union through knowledge. And in this department, we must first clarify some general misconceptions concerning the substance of knowledge. If you look in the dictionary, you will find that knowledge means the fact acquired through experience. Now that is rather different from what we generally understand the word to mean. Thus, knowledge is not derived from books, from the daily newspaper, your favorite commentator, or your public school. Because knowledge has to have the dimension of experience. The dictionary says so. And I rather like that particular point. Apparently, many folks have forgotten the essential meanings of words. Knowledge, then, cannot truly be said to exist apart from certain participation in what we term facts. And this participation means the inclusion of a dimension of internal activity. Therefore, unless things studied, read, and learned are brought to life by some power or energy within the person himself, the state of knowledge is not acquired. Now, this in itself opens an interesting field of speculation, but we cannot pause here. We must now begin to study, if we can, the fact of knowledge. What is knowledge, essentially? What are these facts that must be experienced? And in what way do they contribute to the spiritual growth and integrity of the human being? There are two kinds of knowledge, so-called. One kind of knowledge results from man's impact with his environment and the resulting inflowing of the testimonies of the sensory perception. There is another kind of knowledge which comes from within the person and usually must be experienced through application. Thus, there are two kinds of experience. Man's inward experience of external phenomena and man's power to externalize through experience the internal facts of his life. Thus, inner facts must be outwardly applied. Outward facts must be inwardly applied in order to complete the essential pattern of knowledge. Now, there are things which we believe that we know because we hold them firmly as conviction within consciousness. Yet these things, to be truly known, must be brought from within the life and applied to the phenomena of living. This is why so many theories, which are impractical, but often delightful, continue to dominate the conduct of human beings, leading them into an illusion. Unless these inward realities are justified through application, we do not have the state of knowledge. On the other hand, unless those things which we see, the experiences which occur to us, the reports which come to our attention, the accumulated traditional heritage of learning, which is bestowed upon us, unless all of these are taken into ourselves and subjected to an alchemical transmutation within consciousness, they do not lead to a true state of knowing. Knowing, therefore, implies activity. Knowing without action can never fulfill itself. Anything known must be performed, must be done. A conviction held on the level of knowing must be applied. A code which we know to be right must be lived. The failure to transform these abstractions into practice deprives us of the experiential dimension of knowing. And this experiential part is the part which proves or disproves things held to be true. If in action, if in application, principles fail to operate, then we must assume that we are in error concerning the things which we believe. A man holding a certain attitude toward life, if he finds this attitude is not productive to better living, should reflect, and in all probability finds that he has erroneously interpreted ideas which may in themselves be sound, but which he has misunderstood. Knowing, therefore, most of all implies a laboratory procedure, a process of trying all things and clinging unto that which is good. And that which is outward knowledge must be applied to our inward convictions, to the patterns of motivation within us. If the things which happen to us do not enrich our inner living, we have failed to accept them. And instead of knowledge, we have ended in opinion, prejudice, conceit, fantasy. Actually, if we wish to take an empirical position, which is present strongly in Eastern philosophy, any experience of any kind which does not advance our internal life has been misunderstood by us. Even though that experience may be tragic, may be disastrous, may be apparently unhappy in all of its parts, it has failed to fulfill its purpose if it has not contributed to our understanding of essential good. Now, this might appear to come very close to a platitudinous viewpoint, but either this statement is empirically true, or else the universe is meaningless. Either disasters have purpose, or they do not. If they have purpose in a universe ruled by good, that purpose must be good, and the end of all tragedy must be the support and enrichment of good. Thus, if our external occurrences have not enriched us, we are deficient in essential knowledge. If our internal attainments have not induced us to enrich our world and to profit others and to live well, then again, we have not justified the requirements of the principle of knowledge. The next thing to consider then is that knowledge, per se, or in substance, in essence, in fact, implies two situations or conditions. One is the thing knowing, and the other is the thing known. Knowledge implies a knower. And knowledge consists of the enrichment of that knower, or the communication of fact to that knower. Thus, we have a twofold relation in life, which we like to term subject-object relationship. In our view of living, the knower is the subject. Knowledge is the object. The object of life, we feel, is to grow. To grow implies increase, not only of form, but of knowing. Thus, in Western thinking, the knower is an accumulator. He is an existing being, a principle, a fact, a spiritual living substance, a self, capable of possessing knowledge, capable of accumulating knowledge, capable of remembering knowledge, and achieving a kind of growth through the enlargement of knowledge, so that we regard a person whose knowledge is greater as a person of larger stature and attainment. We consider, therefore, to apply the term wise to the individual is to signify attainments, and that such a person has the internal ornamentation of superior wisdom or learning. The subject-object relation is the cause of a considerable amount of philosophic debate. It brings many correlatives into action. Upon it, other things depend, and it in turn depends upon interpretations of basic principles. So we assume for the moment, but we're not going to leave it there, but we will assume for the moment that each of us is a knower, and that each of us desires to know. The reason for this desire may differ with each individual. Some wish to know because they desire to be better. Some wish to know because they believe it gives them an advantage over others. Some seek knowledge in order to advance their material fortunes. Others to advance their inner living. But as the old adage says, knowledge is power. And it is assumed that the knower has certain advantages over an ignorant person. Advantages relating not only to his own security as an individual, but to his sphere of influence in world affairs and over the lives of other persons. Subject-object, therefore, can be extended into many spheres of activity. But always subject-object on the level of knowledge implies that there exists a being capable of knowing, and that there exists a world of phenomena capable of being known. Now, we all assume this and live without even attempting to define such a concept. We accept it. It is familiar to us all, rather through circumstances than through a formalization in terms of thought or philosophy. Now, this brings us into direct contact with the problem of the knower. Now, just what kind of a being is this that has within it the power to know? Is this a spiritual entity deposited somewhere in the mysterious vastnesses of the composite human being? Is this knower something that is individual, personal? Is each knower a separate entity? Must each knower, therefore, conquer for himself the mystery of things to be known? Is each individual growing alone? Is his struggle from beginning to end his own private battle against unknowing and toward the achievement of the state of complete knowing? If there is a knower within us, what is the substance of that knower? Is it mental? Is the mind the knower? We have come almost to consider the mind and the self as identical. And in a strange way, many of our Eastern brothers would agree with that, but not quite in the way that we would intend them to. Mind has within it what appears to be the center of intellection in the human composition. And it is believed that if consciousness has an inner investment, a subtle body peculiarly suitable to its needs and responsive to its impulses, that this is the mind. Because we cannot conceive of a state of knowing apart from the mind and its physical instrument, the brain. We conceive knowing to arise largely from the impact of sensory perception upon the brain, and its transference in or through the brain to some center of intellection. To the materialist, this center of intellection is a psychochemical process or structure within the brain itself. To the idealist, it is a separate entity, a being apart from brain and inhabiting it as a man might inhabit his house. But we do face one important consideration, that as far as human beings are concerned, man has no experience of knowledge apart from what he commonly terms the brain-mind formula or pattern. Thus he naturally and instinctively assumes that the mind is the source of his power to know, and that whatever may be the deeper implications of his consciousness, these deeper parts must depend upon the mind for testimony. And that the mind is their instrument, their peculiarly sensitized area by which they may receive phenomena, and also through which they may, from within, create patterns which may gradually be objectified through the mind and brain into the exterior life of the person. Thus the mind is a sort of two-way road leading both in and out, and along this road must travel those impulses which relate to internal or external knowledge. Now, is this a reasonable conclusion? Is this the true answer to the problem? What is the relation of mind to knowledge? And we come to a very basic formula, and we have evidence around us to sustain this concept. And it is to the effect that in some mysterious way, what we call the mind is insufficient for the essential purpose which we assume it was created to attain. The one thing that mind cannot give us is truth. This has been a perturbing situation from the beginning. The ordinary products of the mind we can see around us in what might be termed endless confusion. There is nothing in the world more common than mental conflict. Yet if mind has within it the power of the actual and factual possession of knowledge, then there should be an inevitable motion throughout all life, intelligent life, towards identity. If the mind had the power of rapid and immediate perception of realities, we could have very few differences. Because we cannot assume that the inevitable diversity of opinion represents a diversity of fact. It cannot. In the religious world, for example, we have within the field of Christendom nearly 500 sects, each one of which feels that it possesses a peculiar authority, that its own interpretation is peculiarly correct. Now, something is obviously lacking, and the thing that is lacking must be the truth itself. Because if these possessed a truth, they would possess this in common. And about that which is known, there cannot be opinion. But about that which is unknown, there cannot be certainty. We live in a world which indicates that up to the present time, at least, the intellectual equipment of man is incapable of bestowing certainty. If there was certainty, we would not have war. We would not have the endless divergence of opinion among the learned, the schooled, and the skilled. We might still suffer from the opinions of those without knowledge, but we would not find that those who increase in knowledge can still retain highly separate, highly antagonistic attitudes on the same subject. Thus, we must come to the conclusion that either the mind is incapable of the final experience of a reality, or else at this time in human evolution, the human being is not sufficiently advanced to make possible a common experience of mind. And therefore, by either definition, the mind is not immediately available for the solution of the basic problems of life. If the mind is not available, are we to assume, therefore, that these problems are unsolvable and must remain so until some future time, some infinite time to come, in which evolution, growth, unfoldment, education, or culture will so enrich man's inner faculties that he may possess this power of common agreement? There is a tendency, but a very slow and gradual one, for agreement to arise. And the evolution of man does indicate that on certain matters, he is gradually attaining a more holistic perspective. But again, this is far from being sufficient to his needs. Now in the West, emphasizing the Noah, we enter into an incredible cycle of individuation. We then conceive the human race to be composed of an infinite number of separate beings, each of whom must depend fundamentally and basically upon its own knowing power for its security in every department of living. We have learned that collective security does not result in individual security. We have learned that it is perfectly possible to be miserable in a prosperous and apparently harmonious environment. We find that the individual, regardless of his condition or his strength, cannot escape the limitations imposed by his own character and disposition. If, therefore, this process of ultra-individualism continues to be the basis of a philosophy of life, the individual emerges indeed as a rugged, or more likely a ragged, individual. One in whom the struggle for sufficiency must go on indefinitely. Now comes a further consideration. Assuming that this struggle does go on, assuming that in the infinite futurity of things, all these selves, all these knowers, will achieve to a state of sufficiency so that they can become completely self-secure units, what do we then have? Some will say the Golden Age. But we will have arrived at one of the most mysterious and disagreeable concepts conceivable to us if we think it through, and that is we would arrive at absolute static. Every individual, sufficient for himself, sitting on his own doorstep, having answered all questions and solved all mysteries, and therefore probably having achieved in this process actual physical immortality, would sit there forever. Because he would then have no further to go. He would have achieved the fullness of his own capacity, and he would still be a person with all the limitations of a person, unless there is some dimension that goes beyond his present thinking. So here we pause and come back again to the immediate situation. Object-subject. The subject man, the object knowing, or knowledge. And the next consideration which arises from this. If knowledge is legitimate, what is its purpose? Have we conceived even for a moment the essential nature of the purpose of attaining a state of knowledge? We cannot assume, for example, that any definition which relates purely and simply to our material concerns can be sufficient. After all, does it make any great difference on a level of materialism whether a man dies a sage or an imbecile? What is the difference? He is just as dead in either case. Therefore, on a material level, his intelligence is valuable only as a community asset. It is valuable only to others and not to himself. Because wise or foolish, learned or unlettered, he must go down to the dust with all his kind. If we are not material, and assume that there is a survival of consciousness beyond the mortal state in which we live, then the dimensions of knowledge open a little, but we are cursed with a new dilemma. If such is the case, and we are the citizens of a larger universe, and this is merely an interlude in our existence, then of what value is what we learn here when we leave here? Supposing we have mastered the intricacies of chemical gardening, are we going to assume that in the Elysian fields we will have any need for it? Supposing we have actually become the outstanding banker in our community, what will we do on the banks of the other shore? Suppose we have learned great care and difficulty how to split an atom. Where will we use that knowledge? And the whole concept of knowledge as we know it here is limited entirely to a state in which our normal lifespan is 70 or 80 years. Now there are some, and this includes both Easterners and Westerners, who like to contemplate the doctrine of rebirth, who like to feel that there is a continuity of life, not only in space, but in this world, and that the individual may well use knowledge gained here at some future time. He may come back here. But assuming the present rate of progress, and assuming the philosophically accepted interval between embodiments. Supposing we had died in the age of Charlemagne and had been born today, what would the knowledge and skill we had then do for us? If George Washington came back here today after an interval of only less than 200 years, what would his attainments in most departments mean to him? Assuming that which is obvious, namely that most of the things that we do today will be obsolete within a century, that most of our most boasted discoveries will be reversed in 200 years, or will be so far advanced by that time that our knowledge concerning them today would seem little more than infantile. Here again, it looks like we're wasting a great deal of time. Because if we do not do something to housing, banking, and related matters within the next couple of thousand years, by which our present standards are obsolete, we will have made very little of progress in some very important fields. So we cannot assume that the knowledge of particulars, here again, through the processes of training, will be too valuable to us. And experience also seems to indicate that these very forms of knowledge must be relearned in any event upon embodiment, because we have very few instances known, if any, in which a court stenographer of the Roman Empire was born with a shorthand book in his hands or with any greater facility to learn the subject than he had. So here again, the problem rests. But the philosopher might go a little further. It might be hitting a little closer to the truth. He might say, yes, that is true of banking and stenography. It is true of chemistry and art, literature and music. But is it true of morality? Does the ethical standard of man survive? Is honesty going to be any different 2,000 years from now? Is integrity going to be any different? It may be applied in different ways, but is the principle of the power of the individual to weigh all things and cling unto that which is good, does that change? Is there any real difference between Greek or Roman honesty and American honesty? Is there any difference between Hindu idealism of the days of the Vedas and modern idealism? Have these changing times anything to do about man's internal capacity to adjust and therefore to survive? Let's accept that for a moment and think about it. Let us grant it. Let us grant that there may be a kind of ethical knowledge, a kind of knowledge resulting from the enrichment of character, from the enlargement of understanding, from the generosity of spirit. There's that kind of knowledge might have a survival value. It might have a survival value here. And it might have a survival value somewhere else in case man has an immortality apart from here. Assuming man's survival as a conscious being, the only things that can be valuable to him in a different state are principles within his own consciousness, which must be applicable to any state in which a reasonable creature can exist. That's a delightful thought. Then why does it happen that in the 80 or 70 years we live here, we receive every kind of knowledge except that kind of knowledge? And that every effort is made to make us into good bankers and brokers, but it is only by a desperate effort of our own, accompanied by privation and reverse, that we are able to attain to the kind of knowledge that might have a survival significance. Why are these surviving possibilities ignored almost completely throughout our educational system, except in certain sectarian departments? Knowledge, then, must be considered as of two kinds: that by which we can live well here, and that by which we might hope to live well forever. And that knowledge by which we might live well forever anywhere must, on a level of philosophy, have precedence over that which is only useful under certain conditions and at certain times. And there are probably persons here who have been forced in midstream to change their ways of life because the arts, crafts, trades, or sciences with which they were acquainted in their youth and for which they prepared themselves have no longer any vitality. It's like a friend of mine who spent the second half of his life moaning over the fact that he was probably the best buggy whip manufacturer in the country. All the years, nobody wanted any buggy whip. So it has been a matter of often readapting education to the changes within a lifetime, let alone within the great changes of history. But we begin to see a residue of knowledge here that seems to have a permanent significance. And this knowledge goes deeper and deeper into ourselves and relates primarily to these great principles, which must have validity wherever beings with a consciousness such as our own have an existence. If this consciousness does not exist or does not survive, then there is no validity to any point in this argument. But if it does survive and does have an existence, and the individual continues, there is one thing reasonably evident, that if he exists at all, he must get along with himself. We do not know who else he may have to get along with, but if he survives, he must get along with himself. And up to now, that has been one of the most difficult programs that the human being has been faced by, because everything that we learn teaches us to get along with someone else. Not that we do that very well in most cases. That is where the training is emphasized. The object-subject problem carries us a little further. Subject as knower must confront a tremendous mystery and must sometimes contemplate the incredible panorama of that which must be known. We think that some humans are rather smart. But actually, in the presence of the unknown, we are all fools together. With all the attainments that we have made, we have not even lifted the fringe of the unknown. And as we proceed further, we come nearer and nearer to bewilderment. Because the vastness of the universal plan is simply beyond our comprehension as beings. Even if we continued for countless aeons of constant and industrious discovery, we would still be faced by the unknown. And we would come nearer and nearer to the realization that there is a mysterious dark wall that divides the known from the unknown. And any subject on the level of the objective, which we follow long enough and trace carefully enough, goes slowly towards this dark wall and disappears. The noumenal side of existence, the source of things, the causes for things, and the reasons for things, are never immediately available to us. We may observe manifestations, but the nature of the manifesting power is eternally elusive. We have no ability. We can divide matter until matter disappears. And yet when it has disappeared, nothing has been lost except our ability to find it. So we are constantly in the presence of effects, which as we trace them to their causes, seem to disappear and leave not a rack behind. Yet these causes and these causes alone are solutional in the level of knowledge. For without the knowledge of cause, all men are ignorant. Now then, can the knower know cause? That's a very large question. And upon that, we must pause for a moment to consider the relation of the knower to cause. Assuming cause as a supreme fact, and assuming cause to possess within itself the potential of all effect, we must come to the conclusion that if there is anything in the universe that knows all, that thing must be totality itself. Nothing else can. No part can ever know all. Therefore, if there is an all-knowing resident in existence anywhere, that all-knowing reposes in the all-being. And from that all-knowing and that all-being must proceed those things which can be known. and which in themselves possess quality and dimension. If, therefore, there is a plan, and this creation is the unfoldment of that plan, then the only power or being possessing the full and complete knowledge of the plan is the planner itself. The parts can never know, because no part can ever know more than itself. Because the moment it retires to the source of its own existence and becomes identical with self-knowledge, it has reached the termination of its own identity. So all knowing must depend upon an all knower. And an all knower must be totality, must have within itself the capacity of complete existence. And that this complete existence may be regarded as knowing or unknowing is a tremendous question. Is this complete existence to be defined as the all-conscious? Or is it to be defined as the unconscious? In other words, does the root of existence so completely transcend knowing that totality is superior to knowing? Therefore, has an existence apart from knowing? And consequently, whatever its state may be, it is remote even from knowing. Man creates the term unconscious to describe the root of his own or the collective consciousness. But whether he is using this term to mean that which is unconscious or that of which he is unconscious is another large question. Like a small boy who took the attitude, I don't see it, therefore it isn't. Is this term really indicative of anything known, or is it merely indicative of our own desperate effort to define an abstraction? Now, if we assume a totality at the root of existence, and follow certain Eastern systems of thinking, we are going to come to the conclusion that totality is superior to knowing. Therefore, that knowing is a dependency upon totality. And for that reason, knowing can never know totality, because it is inferior to it, or posterior to it in concatenated descent. There was an ancient Babylonian formula, Chaldean also, which says that each thing may be known by that which is anterior to itself, but cannot be known by that which is posterior to itself. In other words, a larger may know all of its parts, but no part may know all of the larger part of which it is a part. Therefore, superior natures may know inferiors, but inferiors may not know superiors. And we use knowing now in the sense of fact by experience, or by actual identification. Thus, the possibility that man is not so foolish as he sounds when he says, my house, my hand, my eye, my body, my mind. But mind is a possession. Mind is something like a body, but is not to be considered as identical with that which possesses, or that which defines, or that which claims proprietorship through anterior order, or through superior state. So assuming for thus the moment, as we seem to have to assume in Eastern philosophy, that totality alone can be all awareness. And also assuming or accepting that which we must accept, namely that we are not going to arrive at a valid definition of totality, because we are not going to be the little fish that could swallow the ocean. We cannot understand that which is infinitely beyond us. Therefore, we are not going to define totality. We are merely going to reason about it. Perfectly aware, as Buddha pointed out, that our reasoning probably will be higher foolishness. But at the same time, may contribute something to a perspective. This totality, if it be, and if it be the cause of our universe, manifesting infinite wisdom, infinite law, infinite life, infinite mind, infinite love, and infinite diversity of harmonic form and proportion, from all that is knowable, from all that is visible, from all that is tangible and to be experienced by man, we derive the grand concept of a universe which is manifesting a supreme skill, a supreme artistry, a supreme sufficiency in the forces by which it was fashioned, by which it is maintained, and by which it unfolds through infinity. Thus, while we cannot define the nature of this infinite, we can become negatively conscious that some of its attributes are in themselves so sublime, so completely sufficient, so transcendent in the manifestations of their power, their integrity, and their validity, that we cannot but assume that the source of these things must in itself be a summation of the known and the unknown in terms of an infinite splendor. Thus, by negative approach, we come to the conclusion that totality is deficient in nothing. That is, to use the Pythagorean term, that it is superabundant in all things. That it is the eternal fountain from which flows everything conceivable. And all of these outpourings, themselves orderly, complete, systematic, sufficient, glorious, beautiful, and good. If this be true, which our limited perspective seems to imply, then we can apperceive but dimly, but still we can sense the infinite, limitless power at the root of existence, and have certain confidence, certain assurance, that the cause is no less than its effect, and that as we see but part of the effect and are overwhelmed thereby, that the totality must be inconceivable. Now, with this situation rather firmly set in our minds, the knower discovers that it may possess knowledge of things less than itself, but it cannot possess knowledge of that which is greater than itself. It can orient its own place in a pattern of parts, but it cannot experience the wholeness of these parts, because it is not all of them. Therefore, as it exists in part, therefore it must think in part, reason in part, hope in part and believe in part. This means, as the Chaldeans so wonderfully explained it, that man may possess inferiors, but that forever and eternally superiors possess him. And this is an interesting consideration. The dog may own his own fleas, but the man owns the dog, and the dog will never own his master. Therefore, in man, the human being may own his house, and he may try to own his relatives. He may attempt to own his business, but he can never own his world. And this is true both of his inner world and his outer world. And those who have tried to conquer the world have found to their grief that the only thing that man who wants the earth will ever get will be the 6 feet of it that fall in his grave. Now, if we think in these terms, let's see what this implies. Let's think through this thought for a moment. A man may know that which is inferior to himself, but must only be known by that which is superior to himself. This becomes his relationship between God and nature, between which man stands. As Goethe says, "Twixt heaven and earth, dominion weakly." Man may unfold the pageantry of his socialized existence on a material plane. But as he turns inward, he turns towards superior. And his relationship with his own origin is always a negative relationship. Whereas his relationship to the things over which he has authority is a positive relationship. So in our Eastern thinking, for a moment, we work with this thought considerably. That man may possess knowledge, but he must be possessed by truth. That he cannot possess it because it is greater than he is. And the individual can no more possess that which is greater than he is than he can eat a meal which is larger than his own body. He must, therefore, in his relationship to superiors and inferiors, recognize that his approach to superiors is through the gradual development of receptive powers, whereas his relation to exteriors is justified and maintained through the gradual development of objective, aggressive powers. Man can never be aggressive toward the infinite. He can never take the kingdom of heaven by storm. He can never force himself into a superior state of being. Nor can he force his own entity above a level on which such entities have their natural existence. So subject-object relationship is subject to a sudden twist. And the individual who says, "I am the subject and life is the object," is referring downward into objectivity. When he turns back and refers upward into subjectivity, he says, "I am the object and it is the subject." In other words, the knower, subjectively, is not himself, because he is one of the things that the knower can know, but he can never know the knower. Thus his relationship is turned. And instead of being positive to an environment that is negative, he suddenly finds that he is negative to an environment that is positive. His spiritual salvation, therefore, depends upon the fact that he is known not the fact that he knows. This is the root of mysticism. Because mysticism is man entering into a receptive relationship to superiors. Now, we do not mean by receptive negative. We do not mean that the individual gradually becomes a non-entity. But we do mean a disciplined receptivity. Now, a disciplined receptivity depends on something, and here's where your disciplines in this yoga become important. You've all known people who were being forever moved by certain quaint impulses from within themselves. These impulses have led them from one infirmity to another. They have also perhaps developed spiritistic tendencies and are being controlled by anything from a pendulum to a Ouija board. These individuals are receptive enough to please anyone, but they are not receptive in the philosophical sense of the word. They are just plain negative. They have chosen to permit themselves to become a vacuum, and as a result have gradually accumulated the trash that was floating around in space. This does not mean the thing that we intend to imply. The individual passing along his way of life moves from one level to another. It would be inconceivable that a child who is 2 years old could enter into a state of divine expectancy, close his eyes, and become 18 years old. We would be very, very much upset if anything like that occurred. Because before he can be 18, he must be 17, 16, 15, 14, and so on, year by year. Before internally, he can gradually ascend to a condition superior to his present state, he must fulfill his present state and not avoid it or evade it or believe that he can. He does not, therefore, fulfill the requirements of a disciplined existence by reverting to a primitive state. We might almost say that there is here the difference between childishness and childlikeness, which is a great difference. Small people are childish. Great sages are often childlike in their simplicity, their humility, their gentleness. The tremendous development of faith and beauty in them. They have certainly moved from a most unsophisticated condition through a sophisticated world and have restored their own unsophisticated internal. They have grown through confusion back again into integration. And in integration, they have found peace, security, and a childlike faith in the reality of things. They have passed from not knowing through partial knowing to a kind of knowing, which does not imply any degree of sophistry, such as we know in education or culture today. So that the disciplines involved are that the individual shall grow, shall form out of his objective life the pedestal for his subjective life. And that for him, while he is in this world, or while he is part of this cycle of existences, cannot safely proceed to the most sacred laws and practices until he has fulfilled. He must fulfill the law and the prophets and not destroy them.